Hello, everybody. Welcome to Artistry and Anecdotes. My name is Erica Thomas. I am the faculty member in the University Studies Department at Portland State University that's the co-teacher with Suzanne Saveria of this PSU Senior Capstone class that put on the event that you're at right now. This is a special live taping of my radio show, which is a KBOO community radio program called Art Talk Bus Stop, where we interview artists about how they do their work and how they make a living. I'm the producer of that show, but I'm also co-producing this event with this group of amazing students who are singing and making concessions for you and interviewing our lovely panelists. So without further ado, I'm going to hand it over to our primary MC of the conversation, Magnolia Robertson. Welcome to you and welcome to all of our guests.
Thank you for all our guests being here today. I guess I'll introduce you guys. We have composer, activist, and piano master Daryl Grant beside me. We are graced with the presence of a Grammy Award-winning musician and co-director of Prismid Sanctuary, Esperanza Spalding. We have a PSU queer opera performer, Frances Bigelow, with us. And the founder of queer opera and another master pianist, Chuck Dillard. Thank you all. So I was wondering, maybe you guys could start us off with maybe telling us about your art and maybe your organizations that you have. Why don't we start with Esperanza, I guess, and talk about Prisma.
Yes. Thank you. About my art and organizations, gosh. I mean, arting is a form of organizing, right? And I think this project, Prismid Sanctuary, is a way to very explicitly kind of legibilize, materialize, embody what the music has always felt like to me. But the way that you're kind of shuttled through your development as a burgeoning professional musician, you're very, I don't want to say strategically because it makes it sound like there's some sort of like grand strategy, but you're very much shuttled towards these kind of goals of capital, right? Like goals of achieving a kind of notoriety. And even whatever your gift or your voice or your sound is, the project becomes like ferrying that towards its marketability, towards its potential to be commodified in these grander and grander ways. So, but that I always had a pull to the land and a pull towards community and a pull towards the responsibility of music to be utilized for our wellness and our harmony as humans in relationship to spirit and land and each other. And I think in the pandemic, when everything stopped, it was kind of like all of the sand and the like murk in the water went down, and I could see again and go like, wait, what? Like, where am I? You know, and remembered what the passion is really from and for. And so I was able in 2020 to start basically practicing another modality of creative expression. No, another instrument of true creative expression, which to me incorporates your relationship to place, your relationship to people, your relationship to your elders, and your relationship to the future generations. But it's so invisibilized in the way the music industry works. So this feels like a more accurate instrument of the sanctuary to really let the project of the sanctuary embody, hopefully make legible, make engageable, make a practice out of, to me, what's always been the heart, the impulse, the source of like my creative duties, my creative actions.
Great.
And if I can just jump in for 1 second, and Prismid is here in Portland. It's a physical place.
It is a physical place, yeah. And it is a non-physical place because it is in Portland. It's in North Portland. What I mean by a non-physical place is, you know, the place is just a site to practice what the sanctuary is about. Like, a place itself can't uphold the principles or the qualities of sanctuary. That's relational. That's practice-based. That's habits that we form that creates like a resonance that we can step into and learn how to contribute to it or be, you know, benefit from it. So I guess I just wanted to add that. Yes, it's a site, but it's a site where we practice the lived experiencing cultivation of what sanctuary can be.
Thank you.
Sure. Well, I'm a jazz pianist and a composer. And when I moved from New York City to Portland, in part because I was looking for something that I wasn't finding in New York. I wanted to feel like I had a connection to place and that I had an opportunity to do work that was meaningful in that place. And as I tell my students at that time, to be a successful jazz musician in New York meant you were never in New York. And so I was traveling and doing that whole thing that you do when you're trying to build a career, but also wanting to feel like what would it be like to be in a place where I could see my impact beyond the applause of an audience when I finish a concert. How could I, what happens the next day and the next day and the next day? And so I was fortunate to find this platform of a professorship at Portland State, kind of fell into that in a whole bunch of synchronistic ways, and that has allowed me to really explore the boundaries of possibilities for what I as an artist can do to move the world towards change. So that's kind of been my interest, both as a performer, as a composer, and also, you know, as a, I don't know if I'd call myself an activist, but as an active an agent, as someone who's sort of trying to use my agency. And Esperanza was a student of mine back here in her 1 year that she spent at PSU. And I have the good fortune to have been able to stay in contact with her and sort of watch, but also participate in some ways and be inspired by and informed by the way that she has moved as an artist in the world. And it just turns out that we have a lot of similar interests in those kind of things about agency and about practice. And so she had asked me when she was starting Prismen, the nonprofit, as a sort of vehicle to embrace and move forward this sanctuary, to be the chair of the board of her nonprofit. And since I have a little bit of experience with nonprofits, and I thought, okay, that sounds like a reasonable thing to try. So that's how I came to be involved in Prismen Sanctuary.
Awesome.
I guess Chuck, you can go down, Chuck.
Sure. First, I want to say thank you to everyone that's here, and also thank you to this space. It's so welcoming and special. It's really a pleasure to be here. I know I'm supposed to talk about queer opera, but you said to talk about your art, and I'm so blessed to be able to have such a wide variety of art that I make every day. And so if I don't make art, I know I'm in trouble, but luckily at PSU and in the community, I have that opportunity to make art on a daily basis. Queer opera came about out of necessity because I saw year after year singers on stage, queer singers that I knew were queer, that identified as queer, telling straight stories, because those were the only stories that were available for them to tell in opera. And I was seeing them not only pretend to be a character, but also pretend to be a gender, or pretend to be straight. And so they had this additional, really substantial barrier or burden that they had to carry or get over in order to tell the story. And one answer would be to start to write new stories, but that's very easy to do for a short story, but for an opera, it takes a little bit more time to get that done, not to mention money. And so what we do is we co-opt the stories that already exist, like La Boheme or Carmen or Romeo and Juliet, and we turn it into Romeo and Julian. And we change a few pronouns and a few names, and then we have a queer story, and then we have people that are able to tell these stories in an authentic way. And it's really been a very powerful thing for the participants, but also for the audience members who want to see modern, who want to see themselves represented on stage, and they want to see their community represented on stage. And so it's been a real treat to participate in that.
Awesome. Frances?
Hello. I'm excited to be here. I'm Frances Bigelow. I'm a current student at PSU. I'm scheduled to graduate in June, barring any unforeseen circumstances. I'm a double music major. I'm studying classical voice and also composition. And I've had the good fortune to participate more than once in queer opera. Dr. Dillard has been a very valuable and important teacher and mentor to me in my education and in my artistry, and I was delighted to get to do that and participate in that. And also, I love opera and I'm very passionate about opera, but it's been very frustrating for me in the past in the heteronormativity of the opera canon and also the way that women are depicted in much of that canon, and that was a really, it was really incredible to get to participate in that project that really reimagined that. And I mean, I sang the role of Susanna in scenes from Carlisle Floyd's Susanna, a wonderful 20th century opera in which, and in those scenes, the traditionally tenor role was sung by a mezzo-soprano. And it was also amazing to get to see, for example, Act 4 of La Boheme with two sopranos singing Rodolfo and Mimi. And that's been very, very influential, I think, in the way that I'm thinking about opera and about music going forward. I want to write operas, and thank you. And I want to tell stories that are a little more in tune with the modern world. And yeah, thank you.
Nice. Well, congratulations. you guys had great answers. I was wondering if, like, we talk about support and stuff on the podcast, so I was wondering, did you guys have a lot of support when you're first starting to do your art, or did, like, from your family and stuff, or did you have to find support in different ways?
I can answer that, or I can answer for myself.
Whoever wants to.
Family, no. But... When I told my mother I was starting queer opera, she said, "Oh, Chuck, you might be gay, but you're not queer." Support, yes, all over the place. People were like jumping up and down about seeing queer stories on stage, about taking what had been and making what is out of it. Financially, that was a bit of another story. We started in 2017, 2018, and then COVID hit, and it is a challenge to find financial support because we don't require any payment from the singers. They all participate for free, and we hire people to support them. So that is an ongoing challenge, but the world that I am inhabiting is hungry for the stories that these singers are telling, and so the support is there. And especially Portland is a safe city to do this. I wouldn't necessarily want to take it to Birmingham, but I would like to start to franchise it out in cities where I know the singers would be safe to do so.
Well, you guys are a lot closer to the start of where you got support, so I guess I'll say that. So for me, yeah, I grew up in a musical family. My father loved music, but was tone deaf. But my mother was a singer, and so I grew up playing for her and my brother and sister. We all took music. So, and I would say that for me, music was a safe place to put my identity as a black young man sort of growing up in an environment that where I didn't see a lot of people like me, but it was really clear that people who looked like me with the talent that I had could go far in that field. And I think that I got a lot of support from the community, both, you know, inside and outside of my family, because they saw that I had that ability. And so, yeah, I guess I would feel like I was supported. But I also chose deliberately, I think, to play a music in jazz music that had more cultural roots and, I think, a tradition of sort of mentorship and sort of generational uplift. And so I think I felt that even before I had that in person. I felt like there were people behind me sort of pushing me towards this, pulling me towards this. So there was that kind of support as well.
I am a lot closer to the start of my artistic journey than I think the other people here. I was really, really lucky. I came from a family that was very supportive of my pursuing music. My parents aren't musicians, but they're very big fans of music, so I was exposed to a lot of music growing up, and when it started to become evident that I had some affinity and some ability, they really encouraged that. I was really, really lucky in that way, and then when I came here to Portland State, I was very lucky to have the support of some really wonderful faculty members like Dr. Dillard, like my composition teacher, Renee Favon-C, my voice teacher, Christine Meadows. It's been a really wonderful community here. I feel very lucky to have a lot of support around me.
Wow. I'm realizing in this moment that I was able to keep moving forward in music once I kind of got the bug when I was 5, because all of these groups of dedicated adults, professional musicians, had created programming for youth, and it makes me get choked up thinking about that, because I came from a very difficult living dynamic. Very poor upbringings, but I was able to keep moving because as soon as my single mom with 2 kids working a million jobs reached out for like, where do we get free support for a young kiddo in music? There was like program after program after program and teacher after teacher, and Shoebuck's Violin Shop had like a instrument loan program. And I'm thinking back and going like, oh my God, it was really, I was able to move because so many people, so many years before I was born, realized that this was important to exist in community. And so my mom, it's not like it was easy, but she was able to like deposit me in these different places, and the places could like usher me forward. And it always felt like that from the time I was 5. The concept of like a struggle, other than practicing, wasn't present because all those people did that. And I remember going to Boston the first time I lived outside of Portland and being so shell-shocked that was not the culture, you know, and just being like, you know, like you have to pay for 30 minutes of a lesson. I was like, what? You know, like just, I really grew up in that richness, you know, that brine. And also that my mom, I don't know how the hell she did, but she found a way to like make that a priority in her busyness. So, yeah.
That's amazing. I guess I could ask some individual questions. I was curious. Daryl, you talked about how you came from New York City and started living in Portland. Was there any differences, obviously, making music and living between the differences? Can you tell us about the differences of living and working in Portland and New York City?
Well, so I thought when I was leaving New York, I was pretty terrified. It's like I'm leaving the jazz capital of the universe, going to this place there, and people are like, "There's jazz in Portland? There's black people in Portland?" It's like, yeah, there is. And but I was amazed to find, like, you know, because of Portland is such a livable place, there were incredible number of amazing musicians. I mean, one of the reasons I came is because when I came here to visit, I was really good friends with this drummer, Alan Jones, and so I came out to visit him, and I met all these musicians who I'd never heard of, didn't have their records, who owned houses. And I was like, what's going on? How is that possible? I'm like working my behind off touring all over. Y'all got, now, I mean, that's a very complicated story, and now I know a lot more about how that story worked. But that was one of the differences, that I think that Portland was very much a place that was very about, like, quality of life, about living well, less about, you know, sort of just making it at all costs. It was less of a competitive place. So that's one of the things. And I mean, obviously, the outdoors and the sort of love of the outdoors that people have here, that was something else that affected me. So those are a couple of things.
Cool.
Yeah, I can jump in here. So for folks who don't know, this is a podcast, a radio show that airs on KBOO Community Radio. So there's going to be another audience that's invisible to us right now, but they'll be listening on the radio. Many of them are teenagers, because we usually record this with high school students at McDaniel on 82nd Avenue. And something we like to talk about with those students is what the soil is that your art grows out of. Is kind of the metaphor. So it's like, what does the inspiration look like for you? What do you do for yourself to prep to do your work? Like, do you have routines? You know, what kind of, like, research goes into it? Those kinds of considerations that you make as creatives and artists. Let's start with Esperanza. You're nodding like you have a thought about this, maybe ready.
It's such an awesome question. And when I think about yes, being in the teenage zone, which is such a special, rich, exciting place, I think of how sometimes when you're studying something, like the terms of the study can kind of make it feel like it's separate from your life. And what I mean by your life is, like, the things that I think occupy the most mental space when we're teenagers, which is, like, relationships, social happenings, stories, gossip, drama, family stuff, parents, where are we gonna go to college, like, how are my grades, how do I feel in my body, how do I feel in my face, in my clothes, like, this is the real, it's real, it's everything. And then it feels like whatever we're studying is like this thing we go dedicate, like, okay, 3 hours, or my sports practice, or my dance class, or whatever, and it can feel really aside. And the secret, which I wish somebody would have told me earlier, is, like, you use everything in your life. You use everything for the art. Everything. The most mundanest little tiff that you have with some clique that you're not a part of anymore, to a fight with your dad, to a heartbreak, to shame, to terror, to disappointment. Like, allow it to serve you the way that it wants to, you know? Like, we make art out of our human experience. And you're never too young to have a deep human experience. And I would just encourage, whatever your medium is, just keep trying to find more ways to use everything. Like, if you're a songwriter, if you're a trombone player, play that in your trombone. Give yourself that to, like, move it through your trombone. If you're a dancer, put it into your dance. If you're a writer, write it. You know, if you're a painter, paint it. And what that starts to do, I think, is, like, work that muscle that we're going to need for the rest of our lives, of feeling very fluent of bringing out what's real to us into our medium. You know, all the classes are going to get you the skill and develop your technique, but you got to have something to make with all that technique. And you can't just emulate or like with your brain, like I'm going to devise something, you know. So just, I would highly recommend that, and it makes us feel better. Mm-hmm. And the teenagers are really hard. It's really, really hard. It's like you're realizing that it was all a lie. You know what I mean? Like it's like it's all a setup. And it's like we have that resource for ourselves that we forget sometimes belongs to us. So.
That's great. Frances, Chuck, do you have any sort of thoughts about your creative inspirations process of preparing to make your work?
You want to go first? All right. The idea of the soil that your art comes from is a beautiful thing, and I was thinking about that. But I can tell you about the seed that got, the very first seed that got right. planted. Was when I was an undergraduate, and I was playing in a voice lesson at the piano with my very best friend, who was a tenor, and he was singing this love song, and I'm gay, and he was gay, and we knew that, and the teacher knew that, but she said, the voice teacher, but she said something like, without even thinking, and this is 1994, by the way, so in this song that you're singing, what does your lover's hair look like? How tall is she? How long is her dress? What color are her eyes? Totally invalidating the fact that the student, my best friend, was gay. And it clicked with me that it immediately just drew a curtain over his art form, mm-hmm. and there was just a big no. Like, he can't tell his story mm-hmm. anymore. As a pianist, I gravitated towards the piano because I was alone. It was genderless. It was not sexual. I could play Beethoven, and it could be whatever I wanted it to be, and I didn't have to hide. But if someone's going to actually share a story, then there are things attached to it. And society back then, and a lot of times even today, had put this... had put all these barriers up, saying you can tell this story, but you can't tell that story, your story. And so I didn't realize that at the time, but when I moved to Portland and I started seeing people express themselves in such authentic ways, I moved here from Texas, by the way, it inspired me to go back and really water that seed and create something where people could be authentic. So that is the story of my seed and the soil of my art form.
Great.
Cool. Well, I would say that for me, there's an answer in my singing and also in my composition. I'm a singer. I'm primarily interested in writing for voice. I've written choral music. I've written art songs. As I said before, I ultimately want to write operas. I'm not quite there yet, but I'm working towards it. And so I work a lot with text, and oftentimes the texts that I choose to set and to work with, I select them because they resonate with me in some way in the moment that I'm working on the piece. And sometimes I don't quite realize consciously until I'm a little further into it, like, oh, that's why I picked that poem. Okay. And then sometimes it is more like, I chose this poem because I'm going through this right now, and this poem speaks to me and expresses something that, I mean, I express myself better musically than I do through words, I would say. It's just easier. And so it's helpful for me when I'm working through things to be able to work with someone else's words that articulate things better than I perhaps can, and to explore that musically. It's a similar thing when I'm singing, because I have performed my own art songs before with Dr. Dillard on the piano, which was a really interesting experience putting together. And I'm generally working with music that other people have composed and sort of bringing to that, trying to bring to it my own experiences and trying to connect to it in a way that's, this is something I've worked on a lot with my voice teacher because it did not come easy at first. It's taken a lot of work. That's also been really interesting to explore. It's a really good way to work through things, I've found.
Yeah, I love that you've recognized where your intuition plays in creating your work. Magnolia, did you have another?
I was actually curious about that. You said you had been working on your voice for a while, so I was wondering maybe with a queer opera, is that something you have to work for to get the voice, or are you born with it, or like, I guess not, but.
Are you asking, like, learning to sing?
Yeah, like, what's the physical demands that comes with being an opera singer? That might be a loaded question.
Or a singer, any
yeah,
singer.
Any singer.
Well, I would say it's, like, a little bit of natural predisposition and natural ability, and then years upon years and hours upon hours of training and work and dedication with a really good teacher is super crucial. I have an incredible voice teacher, Christine Meadows, professor here, wonderful. I don't know about, I mean, are you, Dr. Dillard, what do you think? You've worked with a lot more singers than I have.
Good question. Tying it into queer opera, there really isn't any sort of leap. It's just, I don't know why this just makes perfect sense to me, but you just sing a different name or a different pronoun and then boom, it's queer. if it, you know, is authentic for yourself. So it doesn't take any special training. But I think most of the students at PSU, of which there are several in the room that are currently studying opera, they would all agree with Francis that it does, that you have to, there is some anatomy involved. But beyond that, there is dedication and discipline, which only comes after years and years of training, and also physical development. You know, singing as a 15-year-old versus 20 versus 25 is all very different.
I would love to hear from Esperanza also what your physical training is like for your vocal performance.
Yeah, I would like to know that too. Because it's so different at different times. Yes, I started not studying voice at all because it was this like on the side thing that I could just do, and it seemed to help me get gigs and sing my songs that I was writing. But I didn't think you had to study voice. I was just like, oh, everybody can sing. Like, why would I waste time studying that? Because like kids sing, people sing. It just seemed like it's part of being a human. Then I started to want to sing things that I couldn't figure out by myself. That's basically what happened. I was transcribing, you know, solos of my favorite instrumentalists. I could figure that out. Like, whatever song, like, cool, timbres, finding timbres, da, da, da. Then I got invited to sing a piece by Wayne Shorter called Gaia, which is this 25-minute piece that was so hard. And I started studying with this. I reached out to Diane Reeves, and I was like, Diane, who would you recommend? And knowing that her voice is, like, descended from the heavens, clearly. And surprisingly, she was like, Joan Later taught me everything. You need to go meet Joan Later. So I went and met Joan Later and started learning about this machine in us and was like, what is this? This was here the whole time. And And it was just an amazing awakening. It was like discovering that you had like a car in you. And then I wrote an opera. I wrote an opera with my teacher, that same composer, and planned to just write it. And then about 5/6 of the way through, he was like, I want you to also sing this character. And it was a character who needed to... I knew that I couldn't go do full-on opera in the 1.5 years that I have between then and the performance, but she has to sound like when she enters the operatic world, like we use it as a world, the operatic aesthetic as a world, it's like she can't quite do it anymore because she's learned another truth. So it's kind of perfect. It's like somebody who like knows what it's supposed to be but can't quite do it anymore. And then that was like a whole other territory of exploration of like, yes, unbelievable, this mechanism in us. So now I practice operatic exercises a lot and can sing very short little excerpts as kind of like a fake coloratura. And it's just an incredible capacity expansion for everything else that I do. It's really incredible.
Thanks. Amazingly, we are almost out of time already.
Hey.
I know. But I want to make sure that we leave a little bit of time for audience questions. We have time for a couple. If we're okay to go slightly longer. Yeah, let's go longer. It's always like this. So if you have a question, anyone in the audience is welcome to raise your hand, and Suzanne will find you with a wireless microphone. You don't have to get up. But let us know if anyone has a question that they would. We have a question in the front.
It's on. Esperanza, this is for you. I'm just curious, your decision to move back to Portland as like a location of possibility, if you could tell us more about that, especially in light of all the trouble that has been upon us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from here. I don't know if people know that. I was born and raised here, and I was in Boston at the time, and then two things happened. One, the pandemic, and we didn't know what it was gonna be, right? Like, it could have been anything. It could have, who knows what it was gonna be. And then we stopped having in-person classes where I taught. So those two things happening at the same time, I really thought, wow, if this is the end of the world, I want to be with my family, basically. That was what compelled me. And I didn't need to be out. I didn't really know anybody in Boston. I was like, why would I spend the end of the world here? Or whatever was about to happen. So really, it was, I just wanted to be with my people that I love. I have a very big family. And my mom was 71 at the time, you know. I wanted to be near her, so that was really it. Then when the reality started kicking in of, like, I'm going to leave the East Coast, which I had lived there for 12 years. Like, when I left for school, I never came back. And then, like I said, when the kind of cloud, the dust settled and the murk cleared, I remembered what I've always wanted to do. And I realized that, of course, I should come home and make that practice in my home with my people and the land that I'm from and the community that, you know, like saying thank you maybe to all that this city gave me. And also, you know, every place is crazy. Literally. Every little corner of God's green earth is nuts. But I'd rather be with my family and in a place that I feel like I know how to navigate, I think. And then just like opportunity after opportunity to keep pursuing, or I guess keep cultivating this vision of like a place, a site for these practices with culture and ecology and, you know, elders and kiddos. It just kept seeming possible, and I just kept going. And now I'm like, oh, I'm going to stay here forever, obviously. But that's kind of how it all happened.
Hello. My name is Tyler. I'm a grad student here as well, orchestra ed. Knowing that I think all of you have had students before, what I really want to know is, what are some of the ways or some of your favorite ways that your artistry has impacted your role as a teacher and an educator? Like, what are some things that you noticed that you channel your artistry through when you are mentoring or guiding a student through their own artistic processes? This can be for anybody.
I think I've been doing it the longest.
It's all you.
I think that my goal has always been that students keep their art in their lives for their entire lives. Whether they do it professionally, whether they make a dime at it, I want them to feel like they have an art that's for them and it's theirs and that they keep it. And so that's kind of what I get most inspired by when, you know, I see students coming back and saying, well, yeah, I'm an attorney, but I still have a trio, you know, or yeah, I'm a software engineer and I built this company, and but I still play drums and go to jam sessions like that. I mean, and then some students do that, and that's nice too. But all of it, you know, the fact that their art is theirs and they keep it forever.
I will say for myself, I don't consider myself necessarily to be an activist, but I do wear my queerness proudly. It's been really refreshing to be in a city where I don't feel like I have to be in the closet. And so just by acknowledging that in myself and bringing that into the room with other queer musicians, I have seen student musicians, I've seen time and time again, just a door being unlocked to a room of their own artistry that they didn't have access to before. Whether or not they're telling a story through song or if they're playing the tuba, like just being able to touch the part of themselves that had been closed off has been really powerful for me to bring to my art and my students.
Hello, thank you all so much for being here. I am a master's in urban regional planning student here at PSU. My creative community development practice is very much informed by creative placemaking, so I'd love to get back to that conversation. Exactly what does it mean to create authentic placemaking that shows equity, inclusion, diversity in a place like Portland, for instance? I'm speaking specifically to a project I'm working on where it was actually a festival that is aligned with this radio station, in which placemaking is kind of interpreted, or artistic representation is interpreted as solely representation, and the equity and inclusion process is more based on representation and not so much a process of ground swelling and building from the ground up. And I'm just curious, what would that look like for authentic placemaking in that context, and how can we really promote these ideals that are so inspiring to hear you all talk about?
There's this really cool website that just was launched a couple days ago called prismid.org, right? PRISMID.org. I'm betting that if you look through that, you'll get a bunch of really good answers to that question about how that's happening, because that's the thing, right?
Yeah. Yes. I'm so proud of that website. And it's Prismid with an M, like Mary, or marmalade. Yes. There's no answer to that. It's an embodied practice all day, every day, and some days off. And what I am an initiate in that journey, you know, and I feel very clear and proud of that. My title in the organization is co-director and fellow. I'm an initiate in this life, you know, in this practice, this devotion. What I can say is that even though many of us have not experienced what it is to have our comfort centered and to feel like we have place, longevity, sites of creative expression that we feel expansive in and guided in, lo and behold, as soon as you just invite the question, like, what do you need to feel those things? What do you need to feel included? What do you need for this place to represent your dreams of equity and environmental justice and intergenerational wellness and futurity. Everybody knows, can articulate it, can help you map it out, and will show up for the embodiment of it. That's what we've been learning again and again. Like, it's deeply in our beings. We do know it. And as soon as there's like a little window or opportunity for beings, everyday people, artists, cultural workers, parents, whatever, to have the feeling of like, I'm gonna say this and it's not gonna be sucked up as like, you know, caloric intake for somebody's concept or paper or dissertation, but my words are gonna be like honored and implemented into a place that then I actually feel invested in. It's just amazing what comes forth. Sorry, what's also equally important to all that nice sounding stuff is just to remember that we're all so brutalized by this infrastructure of our society. There's a lot of beautiful things, of course. It's not to negate that. I mean, every single one of us has been chewed up by this system, you know? And I feel it's a really important to like acknowledge that in ourselves. Like, we're gonna vomit our trauma on each other. We just are. We don't mean to, we really mean well. We wanna do the right thing. We dedicate our lives to it. We fundraise, we have the classes, and we're still like carrying this charge of what our parents and our grandparents and us and what we're seeing and our disappointments. So it's really, really important. We're learning again and again to integrate care practices for metabolizing that stuff, you know, have conflict exploration experts around, create a culture of not canceling each other when our stuff comes up. And like, there's a lot of knowledge and a lot of research and a lot of practitioners right here in Portland. I have a list of 4 people of color who do this work, that you really, like, you wouldn't go set somebody's leg by yourself if you weren't. What's the name of the doctors who work on bones? That, you know, and similarly, like the intricate space of our owies and how they bump into each other when we actually, surprisingly, it's like doing the work of wanting to transform it, dredges it up, and we have to face like all these owies and realize like, oh yeah, my parent or my grandparents never felt safe in place. Like, you know, it's really painful. And so just to like honor that, ground in that, and know that it's not just buildings and finances and cool projects. Like, there's a lot of foundational healing practices that are required to sustain the work. And you shouldn't wing it. We don't have to wing it. There are people who've been working on this for decades, for lifetimes, for generations, and they're ready to be activated. Like, you have to pay the accountant, pay the community practitioner who can do conflict exploration and lead you guys into making agreements, you know? And probably start there even before you get into the like, how do we make diversity and inclusion, you know? Okay.
Absolutely. Suzanne, how are we on time?
We are 7:00.
Okay, great. Well, it's been a pleasure to hear from each and every one of you. I wish we had more hours in the day to stay and talk with you. I just want to thank Esperanza Spalding, Mick Rose, Daryl Grant, Chuck Dillard, Francis Bigelow for being our guests today. Not Mick Rose. Mick Rose did...
Well, yes, Mick Rose is a co-director of Prism at Sanctuary, and they were pulled away to Seattle, but send their blessings.
But we do thank them anyway.
Absolutely, we do.
Thanks to everyone for being here. Thanks to Magnolia for co-hosting with me.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to the KBOO audience listening at home. So this is our show airs the 4th Wednesday of every month on KBOO at 11 in the morning till noon. And if you're listening at home, you're listening to 90.7 KBOO.FM. And thanks to the live audience for being here and your lovely questions.
Yay.